It is Monday, November the 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, the Trump 10 transition team's quite busy, plus EU foreign ministers meet about the U.S. president-elect, but three nations were a no-show.
The British or the Brexit, they're on their way out. The Hungarians are very conservative, very right-wing. And the French, there was a recent poll in France that pointed out that 57% of Frenchmen would like to think about leaving the EU, and they'd rather be French than European.
U.S. Muslim community reacting to the Trump election, Japan shifting where it invests, plus the passing of a rock and roll superstar. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has been meeting with his White House transition team, their goal to choose members of the Trump cabinet and other top administration positions. So far, Republican National Committee Chairman Rance Priebus has been tapped to be the next chief of staff. That is the highest-ranking White House employee who is basically the top assistant to the president. Kellyanne Conway was an advisor to the Trump presidential campaign and is now part of the transition team.
It'll be a fabulous cabinet filled with people who are qualified to do those jobs and who understand very clearly what his goals are. He's laid them out very specifically as a 100-day plan that he's put out there for everyone to see, and he will surround himself with men and women who agree with that or are capable of doing that. And look, I think divided government ends up being an excuse after a while, and the excuses are over. We have a Republican president, Republican House, Republican Senate, a majority of Republican governorships, and 69 of the 99 legislative chambers are also Republican in our state. So there's a mandate from the public to actually get things done, and he will do that.
Conway also responded to reporter questions about the anti-Trump protests going on across the country, where tens of thousands of demonstrators are taking to the streets.
He has spoken clearly for a year and a half about his positions on all this. Obviously, those issues and his positions got him elected, as well as his understanding what the cultural zeitgeist is. My message to them through Mr. Trump is what he said the other night on the stage when he declared victory, which is, I'll be the president of all people, even those who disagree with me.
And Bess Friedman was one of the anti-Trump demonstrators on the streets of Los Angeles over the weekend.
We're worried about our rights. We're worried about the Supreme Court, climate change, so many different issues on the table. And we feel that so many things have been validated in this election that we're scared and concerned. And we all have children, and we want to have a safe future for them.
Chauncey O'Connor is a Trump supporter who was out among anti-Trump demonstrators in Miami.
My point of view is this is America, and as a veteran, on Veterans Day, it would be inappropriate for someone who stood up for the country for the way it was built to not be here to show support for the country. And that's why I came out, even though I know I'd be outnumbered about 3,000 to 1.
Anti-Trump protesters marching for a fifth straight day on Sunday were energized by Mr. Trump's announcement that he will deport as many as 3 million undocumented immigrants from the U.S., with perhaps more to come. Meantime, European Union foreign ministers, minus the ministers from Britain, France, and Hungary, held special talks Sunday to discuss how to deal with the new president-elect. There was a number of issues on the table on which some European leaders have said they hope to keep consensus with the U.S. under Donald Trump's leadership. Those include Russian leader Vladimir Putin, the Iran nuclear deal, climate change, and the transatlantic trade relationship with Washington. VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with University of Denver scholar Jonathan Edelman about the potential division among EU member states over these kinds of issues in light of the Trump election.
I think it reflects a fundamental division there, because after all, the British or the Brexit, they're on their way out. The Hungarians are very conservative, very right-wing. And the French, there was a recent poll in France that pointed out that 57% of Frenchmen would like to think about leaving the EU, and they'd rather be French than European. So I think the fact that those three were not there isn't necessarily a sign at all that they were anti-American. In fact, with the British and the Hungarians, I would say, especially the Brits, they're very pro-American. For a lot of obvious reasons. But I think the notion that the EU, which with 28 members has not been able to get its act together on so many things, is going to somehow do this together with the United States, I really don't think so. I think the United States will be able to work with its traditional allies like the Brits, and in this case the Hungarians and others. But basically, the attitude, to, as you mentioned, to Vladimir Putin is going to be very important. I mean, the Donald seems to want to see if he can make a deal with Vladimir Putin. And I would argue it's not impossible. It may be difficult, but there are possibilities for us there.
Given the current issues and the statements that Mr. Trump has made during the campaign and the fact that this election result caught just about everybody by surprise, what is the future of the free trade pact between the U.S. and Europe, the future of NATO, the future of climate change efforts, and also the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, if we start and take them in reverse, the Iran nuclear deal, there's an irony here. And the irony is that Donald Trump has made very clear, and I heard him give a talk earlier this year in New York, that he wants to just get rid of the nuclear deal. But the problem is that the United States, technically, since much of it was executive order, could do a fair amount of that by themselves. However, the deal includes European countries and Russia and other countries, and they may well not want to do what the United States wants to do. So that's going to be very problematic. The United States may find itself not necessarily alone, but not doing it together with the EU. In terms of the other things, defense, I think, is the one area of the four that I think we can get an agreement, an easy agreement, because the problem is the Europeans as a whole are spending far less than 2% of their GNP on defense, and they are duplicating each other. So in other words, they don't have capability to project power at any significant distance. So I think that Donald Trump would like to see the Europeans pay more for what the Americans are doing, but also be stronger than they currently are in dealing with, you know, problems in the Middle East and potentially Russia, which, of course, could get in the way of what he wants to do with the Russians, but not necessarily totally, because the Russians are going to have to make a fundamental decision if he does offer them a deal. And that is, what is he going to do, Vladimir Putin, about his current relationship with Iran, which was so strong that a few weeks ago, you remember, that Russian bombers were taking off from Iranian bases to attack positions in Syria. So he's going to have to decide which side he wants to come down on. And I think in the short run, he can do it both ways, which he is. But I think in the long run, he's going to have to make a decision. And that's not going to be something that we're going to be forcing on him or the Europeans. It's something he's going to have to decide, which way does he go.
There is a media report that quotes a source within the Trump team, if you will, not administration, obviously, that suggests that the U.S. is looking for quick ways to pull out of climate change agreements. Is this going to pose a problem with its relations with Europe?
Absolutely, because Donald Trump doesn't really believe very much, if at all, in climate change. But secondly, he would make the argument, presumably, the kind of rational argument you could make being against climate change, the one you could make, is that this may take considerably longer time than people are currently estimating. In other words, he's only going to be president for 4 or 8 years. He could make some basic, you know, beginning steps, but that's about where it's going to be. But the Europeans are very into climate change, as was the Obama administration. So I think there we're going to see a clash, a very significant clash. But the irony here is that the country that's most important is neither the United States nor the countries that are in the EU. It's the Chinese. Right now, they are emitting more pollution into the Earth's atmosphere than either we or the Europeans. So the question about the Chinese and what they're doing in the South China Sea and their, you know, aggressive attitude towards the United States in certain areas, they're going to have to make up their minds what really matters here, because we would like to see the Chinese spend billions of dollars and try to reduce it. They are in Beijing on the worst days, and I've been there because I've been to China 19 times. They are emitting as much as 25 times more pollution than is allowed in the United States in major cities. Something's got to break here.
Edelman also noted on the transatlantic trade agreement that he believes there is a gap in the Trump team between rhetoric and reality, and that a Trump White House might likely compromise with European nations to keep a lot of the trade deal alive. Jonathan Edelman is a University of Denver professor with a concentration in comparative politics. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. As I mentioned earlier, many thousands of people have taken to U.S. streets to protest Donald Trump's election as the next U.S. president. They have expressed concern about how minorities will be treated under a Trump administration in light of campaign promises Mr. Trump made and his way of speaking about certain peoples. During the campaign, Trump indicated that something has to be done about the number of Muslims allowed to immigrate to the U.S. and that Muslims who are already here should be closely watched. He cited as the impetus for all of this the main attacks, the many of them, by Muslim extremists in other countries and in the United States. For some perspective on Muslim reaction to the Trump election, my colleague Lori London speaks with Dawood Waleed. He is executive director of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, also known as CARE.
What are American Muslims feeling about the election at this point?
The American Muslim community as a whole is feeling like other communities of color and minorities at this time, which is a great amount of concern as far as where our nation is actually heading in a new era of Donald J. Trump.
What are some of the biggest concerns?
Well, there are short-term concerns and long-term concerns. So the immediate concern is prior to Mr. Trump even being inaugurated, there's been an increase of hate crimes all throughout the country against communities of color, including Muslims. And according to the Southern Poverty Law Center, from Election Day until Saturday, there's over 200 reported incidences that are, you know, post-election hate that have taken place. So that's very concerning. And that's just right now. God knows what's going to happen after the inauguration. But the long-term consequences are the policy concerns, the concerns of mass rounding up of immigrants through immigration custom enforcement, the issue of revisiting the Muslim ban where many of our family members and friends may not be able to get visas to visit, much less get citizenship, and also the increasement of mass surveillance against the Muslim community, which is already a reality that started during the Bush administration.
How worried are people? Are they feeling emotional? What do you say to those people when they express their concerns to you?
Well, what I've been telling people in the community is that we need to take the proper safety precautions for ourselves, protect our families and our institutions, but we need to also be prayerful that, you know, this is part of God's plan and God is in control, and we don't know the ultimate outcome of what's going to take place. So we need to be security conscious and prayerful. But in that regard is a third component, that we need to join other concerned Americans and be involved in organizing for positive change, that we want to see our country take a different turn away from the hateful and divisive rhetoric that has been taking place during this election cycle.
And you mentioned the uptick in hate crimes. I know you are in Michigan, and something happened there. Can you tell us what that was?
We've had more than one incident in Michigan. The latest one was a female student at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor, not too far from campus, was approached by a white male, and a threat was made that if she did not take off her hijab, that he was going to put her on fire. So she complied, and right now campus security is working with the Ann Arbor Police Department and investigating that. We're hopeful that if anyone knows any information, they come forward, and that the Washtenaw County prosecutors, if this individual is caught, that he is charged under the ethnic intimidation law that we have here in the state, because from our vantage point, this is a clear hate crime.
If we wanted to summarize this, is there a plan of action within the Muslim community to deal with some of these concerns at this point, or is it a wait-and-see approach?
Well, tonight we're actually having a teleconference with the more prominent Muslim leaders throughout the country. I plan on joining that call, and there's been a number of things that have been discussed about a plan of action about where we go from here. But the primary concern is how are we going to keep our institutions safe, as well as people who are visibly Muslim. And the most the people who are most at risk right now are Muslim women who wear the hijab.
Dawood Waleed is executive director of the Michigan chapter of the Council on American Islamic Relations, that's also known as CARE. He was speaking with International Edition's Lori London. Later in the program, the social media buzz about the Trump election and what's next. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Japan's investment interest has been progressively shifting from China to the markets of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, also known as ASEAN. For some insight into why all of this is happening, I spoke with Izumi Devalle. She is a Japan expert and economist at the Hong Kong and Shanghai Banking Corporation. She says Tokyo's chief interest in Southeast Asia is economic.
China used to be the traditional recipient of Japanese investment, but due to the fact that wages are going up, the Japanese manufacturers are increasingly shifting their production and pursuing a China plus one strategy. They're increasingly making Thailand the center of their manufacturing production, at least, and then utilizing even more low-cost producers such as Cambodia and Laos and Myanmar and Vietnam.
And what part might so-called Abenomics, based on Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's economic plan for Japan, play into this shift of investment interests to Southeast Asia?
Despite the fact that Abenomics has lifted the hopes of Japan's near-term growth, there are still a lot of question marks around the country's long-term outlook. You have a declining population, and it's not unclear when these structural reforms are going to lift growth rates. So I think part of it is not just using Southeast Asia as a production base, but also corporates increasingly see this as a very vibrant consumer market in and of itself, given the very robust growth rates and the rise of the middle class.
And what about geopolitics? What part does that play in Japan's shift of interest?
Abe is pursuing a diplomacy that's centered around Asia and trying to in some ways, assert Japan's position in the region. And the way he's doing this is through strengthening his ties with ASEAN. I mean, this is not to say that he's being hostile towards China or is not putting any importance on the Sino-Japanese relationship, but because of Japan's historical ties with Southeast Asia, he's sort of gone the route of getting friendly with those nations. So I think it's very telling that he's had a very busy diplomatic schedule. I think the busiest in recent memory for a Japanese prime minister. But his first foreign visit was to three ASEAN nations. I think that's really telling about the importance of ASEAN to his diplomatic agenda.
Well, you mentioned that Japanese companies, small, medium, whatever size, might be going to Southeast Asia for manufacturing. Are there other interests there, other investment opportunities other than just manufacturing that attract them to the area?
Of course. I mean, one of the trends that we've actually seen is the rise of non-manufacturing FDI, especially in the so-called core ASEAN economies like Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, that have seen wages rise. So for Thailand, because the wage competitiveness has been eroded a bit. Japanese firms are still focusing on Thailand. It's just that they're investing in non-manufacturing sectors. Like one, a big one is financial services. What we've noticed this year is that there's been a string of very high-profile M&A deals of Japanese banks buying up Thai banks. We've also had a Japanese insurance company buy up an Indonesian insurance company. So I think this is the trend we're going to see in terms of Japanese investment into ASEAN is that in the core ASEAN economies, it's going to be more of an emphasis on non-manufacturing FDI. And then in the non-core ASEAN regions, such as Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, Vietnam, you're going to see the surge in manufacturing FDI.
And we also hear a great deal about Chinese enterprises being actively involved in Southeast Asia. Is this a big competition between Japan and China with regard to Southeast Asia?
I mean, I think if you look at both the Chinese government and Abe's diplomatic tours, you know, they bring along all their corporate leaders. I think when Abe went to Myanmar, he brought a delegation of 40 business and academic leaders, which is, you know, he directly sold Japanese products to these governments. So it's definitely a state-led push as well.
Izumi Devaye, a Japan economist at HSBC. She was speaking from her Hong Kong office. I should note here that it's just out today that Japan's economy grew to an annualized rate of 2.2% based on stronger exports as well as housing investment. And China's retail sales growth slowed to 10%. And that has economists worrying as a sign for domestic demand. And it's time now to see what's trending out there on social media. Our own social media expert, G. Abby Lee, is here. G, social media must be all abuzz with what's next now that Donald Trump's been elected.
Hi, Steve. That's what a lot of people are discussing on social media. Sunday talk shows spearheaded the talks on how the two major parties and the country can move forward.
Hey, G, what are the main topics of discussion?
I'll say two main things, anti-Trump protests and the Democratic Party's leadership. On ABC News, Trump surrogate Rudy Giuliani said anti-Trump protesters are quote-unquote professionals and that they don't appear to be carefully studying political science. One Twitter user wrote, "Whether they carefully study political science or not, they still get to have a voice and an opinion in a democracy." On the other side of the spectrum, Hillary Clinton surrogate Cory Booker appeared on NBC News and talked about the protests, too. About his interview, his critics urged him to look into his own party's hate and that there is a difference between protesters and rioters. That criticism is referring to an incident in Portland, Oregon, where the police ruled the protest a riot.
So there's a massive rally scheduled for late January, isn't that right? What are people saying about that?
Yep, the Million Women March was one of the trending topics on Twitter on Sunday. A day after Trump's inauguration on January 21st, more than a million women are expected to protest his presidency. As many of our listeners already know, his treatment of women was an important issue during his campaign. Anyone interested in the march should check out the Women in the World account at Women in the World to receive up-to-date news. Even men are chiming in on the conversation. One user tweeted, "All LGBT men should protest at inauguration in full drag to wingman the women and girls of this country." Trump's female supporters claim the march is un-American and show their unwavering support for the president-elect. To those tweets, his critics said protest is protected by the First Amendment's right for free speech and right to assembly. Steve?
Many thanks to you, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. By the way, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman. And our program, International Edition, is on Twitter at VOA_IE. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Among the most mysterious objects in the universe are Lyman Alpha Blobs, or LAB. A LAB has been described as a huge cloud of hydrogen gas in distant areas of space. Since its discovery in 2000, scientists have been stumped by what causes a LAB to shine so brightly. Studying one of the largest objects found so far, a team of astronomers say they found two galaxies at the object's core that are forming stars at a rate over 100 times that of the Milky Way. Surrounding these two prolific galaxies is a swarm of smaller galaxies, which the team says appears to be an early phase in the formation of a massive galaxy cluster. It's thought all the star-making activity may be producing the UV light that illuminates the surrounding cloud of hydrogen gas. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. We have some sad news today. Leon Russell, who performed, sang, and produced some of rock and roll's top records, has died. He was 74. Russell recorded hit songs like Tightrope and Lady Blue. His last performance was in July.
Well, you've shown me a different sign. Even as your flame has died, you get used to me, baby. But you just wait and see. Cause I've been in love before, and I love you a whole lot more. And if you want it to be real good.
Yeah, that's Lady Blue, one of Leon Russell's big, big hits. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here for the Voice of America's International Edition. Always good to have you with us. Latest world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope everyone has a great Monday. It is sad to say that Leon Russell is gone, but actually, for sure, his music lives on.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
Ezzedine Abdel Aziz Khalil, who is better known as Yassin Al-Suri, is a senior operative of the Al-Qaeda terror network, living in Iran and moving money and recruits for the group across the Middle East. A native of Syria, he is 29 years old, is an ethnic Kurd, has black hair and brown eyes. Since 2005, he has operated out of Iran under an apparent agreement with the government there as part of its support for international terrorism. By way of Iran, Yassin Al-Suri facilitates the movement of recruits for Al-Qaeda from the Persian Gulf region to Pakistan and Afghanistan. He is also an important fundraiser for Al-Qaeda and has collected money from donors and other fundraisers throughout the Gulf, again with the cooperation of the Iranian government. These monies are then sent to Al-Qaeda leaders in Afghanistan and Iraq. He also arranges for Al-Qaeda members being held in Iran's prisons to be released and sent out of the country to Pakistan. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to Yassin Al-Suri's location. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.